Stop that, stop that. Okay, well, we've had literally several emails from listeners containing feedback on our podcast. It's mostly been abuse, but two emails did stand out. Buzzomatic said, can you please make a version of the podcast without the terrible intermission music? You'll be pleased to hear, Buzzomatic, we've refrained from our usual music for this podcast, and you'll be hearing something different the entire way through. Also, Hugh emailed us to say that he finds it very hard to distinguish between Andrew and Graham, so we'll let you into a little secret here. Graham wears the hat.
It's a fez.
I'm not wearing a hat.
Contrary to popular wishes, we haven't all given up our day jobs to become a Jackson 5 tribute band, mostly because there's only four of us. This is the Tux Radar podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
I'm Graham Morrison.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
This is, of course, episode 12 of the podcast, and as per usual, all the notes will be on the website, where you'll find news, features and more on tuxradar.com, so bookmark it today. If you fancy parting with your hard-earned cash, I'm speaking to you, Buzzomatic. You can go to tinyurl.com/podcastlxf and subscribe to the magazine for a very small sum indeed. In this episode, we're talking mono. It's finally safe to use, apparently. Ubuntu's launched its 100 paper cuts movement and our open ballot, Do Version Numbers Matter? And here is where we'd play some Brad Sucks music for our intermission music, but we're not going to this time.
God, it's raining outside again. Believe it.
Can't believe Michael Jackson.
No, I know. I always prefer Prince.
Really? I'm a Prince fan.
Yeah, but you're wrong, aren't you?
Well, you know, give me 50 Michael Jackson songs that can compete with Alphabet Street.
Heal the World.
Well, there's Man in the Mirror.
The top news this fortnight, Microsoft has just promised not to sue people for using Mono, which is obviously conclusive proof that Microsoft loves us and wants us to be happy. Do you agree?
Well, they promised not to sue over C Sharp and the runtime, well, the CIL infrastructure, but not necessarily the other
CLI
libraries as well.
Infrastructure.
CLI, there we go.
CIL is also .NET, but something else entirely.
Shows how much I know then. But so they're not guaranteeing not suing them at all, are they? It's still two specific areas of Mono. That's why they're going to split Mono up.
Sure, yeah. So there's there are at least three parts of Mono that they are splitting away into their own mini Mono, which is now known not to be safe.
Yes.
Namely, Windows Forms, ADO.NET, which is the database layer, and ASP.NET, which is the web stuff. MS has said nothing about those, because they're not standardized by ISO or ECMA, fair enough. But they have said everything else, all the standard libraries, the CLI, is all okay. Go ahead and use them, lads.
Right, so WinForms is still potentially risky.
Correct, but we don't use WinForms on Linux.
No.
I think it runs on Linux using GTK, I think. I think it's written from scratch. It's written from scratch.
It was rewritten, wasn't
it? Yeah,
it was.
It was all from scratch, sorry. We're not using it. FSPOT's all GTK sharp. You know, GNOME 2, GK Sharp. There's no problem with that. You know, they can keep Windows Forms. That's all right. We don't want it.
Doesn't that break Silverlight compatibility?
Actually, curiously, no. Because the Silverlight widget stuff have largely been given away by Microsoft under a different license.
Right.
Mysteriously. They've been quite giving recently, which I think everyone's very suspicious of. Also, they gave away, what do they call it? The ASP MVC framework.
Huh?
The model view controller stuff they gave away. It's complicated, yeah, but it's free. And people are saying, how dare they include this Microsoft stuff? Well, because it's a free software accepted license by the FSF. They say it's a free software license. Why would we not include it? It's completely fine. So there's as increasing amounts of MS code actually going into Mono, which I think is great because it shows they're willing to take part in the community.
So does this mean that the row over Debian including Mono is over now?
It's gone. It doesn't exist. You know, because Tomboy was the complaint, and Tomboy is GTK sharp, and, you know, the things like reading and writing files, which is included in what's included in the promise. So there's just no argument anymore. It's not a worry. I read it, and I was genuinely surprised. I thought, it's like I'm dreaming. This is so wonderful and so perfect. I want to dance for joy. Thank you, Microsoft.
Don't stop till you get enough.
It's amazing. I was really blown away. It suddenly makes what was it, a long-standing Linux fight.
Yeah, well,
evaporate.
On almost every podcast
I know, we have. Yeah. I don't even. Why did they do it? It should have been great for them, surely, to keep this massive uncertainty and infighting taking place.
Do you know what has prompted Microsoft to do this? Is it the recent debate in Debian and Ubuntu and Fedora?
No, I don't actually know. It's completely flawed me.
I think this is part of the problem, isn't it? Microsoft may be legitimately doing something good to try, but everybody's suspicious. Why would they do this? Why would they do it?
Well, it does worry me a little bit. Because one of the defences for Mono was, Microsoft will never, enforce their patents that they have over it, But this demarcation between what is definitely never going to be fought out in a patent dispute and what might be, or we don't know, we haven't quite said yet, is a bit sinister, I think. Admittedly, they must have, in ASP.NET and all those other things that they're not covering under this, they must have a lot of proprietary technology they're not willing to share.
It's not that, because ASP.NET has already been re-implemented on Mono using Mainsoft's code. It's not proprietary technology. We know exactly what we want. What they're saying is, these bits aren't standardized. They're ours. You can't use them. We invented them, not you. And that's fair enough. In the US. Well, you can patent such things.
Right, I see.
It's all well-known stuff. We know all the function calls have copied with Mainsoft. But now they're saying, listen, we're not covering those because they're not standards. And that makes a lot of sense. But it leaves this gigantic amount of stuff that is covered.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And that is now above, and I can't even believe I'm saying these words. It's amazing. It's now above suspicion. We can actually legitimately use these forever and ever. They're really cool technologies and we can use them. And I'm really hoping that a lot of the GNOME folks are equally excited. We can suddenly switch to this and not worry anymore, not doubt anymore, get all these wonderful benefits of C# without any fear. I'm just amazed. Why did they do it?
What was your pick of the fortnight last time?
It was Vala.
That was it. Yeah. So our slight criticism of Vala was that it was a bit unsure on whether
that's
they
true,
would
yeah.
I mean, that completely throws that argument out the
it
window.
Does
Vala
indeed,
is
yeah.
now completely
Vala is
in the clear.
Is it?
Well, isn't it just the C-sharp?
If C-sharp is, but it doesn't mean Vala is. Yes, well, one of the things that Storm was saying a few days ago was that C# is owned by Microsoft, you can't use it, la la la. But he didn't mention Vala. And it sort of raised the same sort of questions. Why is it that Vala could always get away with it and C# couldn't? And it doesn't matter now because we can forget Vala.
Right, I see. Just go to C#.
Just go to C#, yeah. It's not quite as fast as Vala, perhaps, but it's already working, already here, already used, it's great. I actually emailed Roy Shestovitz, the Boycott Novell guy, asking for comments, but he hasn't got back to me yet. he's probably had a heart attack. He doesn't know what's happened. I'm out of a website here, guys. Moving on, the fights are continuing over HTML5. It's been an awfully long time since HTML4, isn't it?
Isn't HTML5 supposed to really kick in 2020, as I understand it? I'm sure that's what it said originally.
I think it might change now because they've canned XHTML2. That was due out and looked exceedingly complicated, so everyone thought, nah, let's do HTML5 instead.
Well, I was reading the discussion about this earlier, and people were saying, oh, Ogg Theora hasn't been a commercial success, therefore, ditch it. it's really, really strange.
Yeah, but I remember that comment. Someone was saying how X264 is more open than Ogg Theora because it's got documentation. I don't understand.
I think for any video format to take off on the net, it's got to offer benefits over Flash at the moment. The Flash plugin loads quickly, and it just works. So it's a bit unreliable at times, but for YouTube, it's great.
And virtually everyone has it.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas I presume to roll out an HTML5 browser to more than 3/4 of the world would take a very, very long time.
Well, yes. Well, what's Firefox's percentage now? It's about 1/4, isn't it, of all web browsers?
If you're lucky, in some countries, perhaps.
Yeah, I think so. And then, so if they do it, and if Safari does it, but
and Opera does it, and you've got 26%.
Yeah. until Microsoft supports this, then
correct. And there's no way in hell that's going to happen.
Well, after this news about Mono, who knows? Maybe we're going to see a whole new Microsoft.
I can't see it.
Cute, whoa, cuddly
WDM.
Microsoft.
Yeah.
We got rainbows
Silver
on
light.
The logos.
Yeah.
But then after this news about the Windows 7. Yes, that's not going to be. It's not going to have a web browser included in it.
In
anymore.
The EU, yeah.
So, is it just the EU? Is it the EU and
just the EU?
Just the EU.
Not Switzerland.
No.
Or Norway, is it?
Damn, I was pinning my hopes on Switzerland. Well, presumably that means we can see the market share of Firefox increase by at least some proportion of
3 or 4
of the EU users.
Well, I mean, they're going to, I know it's getting a bit off topic, but they're going to have to provide some way for people to get hold of a web browser, because the vast majority of users will get this computer and say, where's the internet?
Yeah. No, no, they don't have to do that. You see, I think this is actually a cunning plan for Microsoft to get idiots off the web. If you're not smart enough to find your own web browser, you don't deserve to be on the internet.
But then there'll be fewer people to troll, so...
Can you not do apt-get install Firefox?
You could try, if you can find the Windows shell.
It has got an ls command.
That's
Windows awesome. 7.
Really?
Yeah, ls works. Whoa!
I'm installing it tomorrow.
So back to the topic then, HTML5. Og Theora is a problem, of course. People are saying that it's potentially full of submarine patents. Which is FUD. And also cunningly sidesteps why Apple still doesn't support Og Vorbis, which doesn't have submarine patents because that's their own thing written from scratch. So just why is it not used?
How many patents cover H.264 or MPEG-4?
Probably quite a few, but Apple's on the licensing committee. So they get some of the money. They probably have their own submarine patents on H.264. Yeah, it's quite a suspicious argument, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean...
Also, Chris DeBonis said they've done tests on YouTube and found that Theora wasn't as good.
Wasn't as good?
It doesn't surprise me. They're always promising that the next version of Og Theora will be the one.
Yeah. Theora is clearly not up to scratch in terms of the very best.
Yeah.
It is, what, 10 years old?
Apparently, yeah.
Yeah.
Which surprises me.
On 2's codec, whenever that came out. Was it VP2? Ancient stuff. It's very old. Mm. And they only tweaked it a little bit, which doesn't seem like quite enough work, really.
Lads.
Must try harder.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, because, you know, Google have nothing to gain by going either way, so I think they're probably being quite honest about it. They obviously have a huge bank of video material to test out on and to fiddle with.
Yeah.
And with that thriving debate, let's draw a curtain on the new section, but there is no intermission music. Fortunately, we do have Mike Saunders. Take it away, Mike.
Join us now and share the software. You'll be free hackers. You'll be free.
That was excellent, Mike.
Very, very good.
The sad thing is you can't tell whether that's Richard Stallman or Mike having a laugh at Richard Stallman. It all sounds the same,
that's
sadly.
That's the power of the internet.
That's the power of the internet. And let's move on to our next section.
Which is the hot topic. Ubuntu's 100 paper cuts. Some of you may have heard of this, some of you may have seen this. This is a bug reporting system that Canonical have launched, where they're trying to find the most small but annoying or niggling little problems on the Linux desktop. Stuff that we don't really think about as a day-to-day Linux user, like why does it say auto etho in the network manager? You know, we kind of know what's going on, but for new users, that just makes no sense. It's something that could be fixed very easy and very quickly. So, what do we reckon? Good? Bad?
Awesome idea. Fantastic. Awesome. I remember when we Future Publishing tried to migrate to NeoOffice a few years ago, and folders were called directories, and it was all about, and all the dialog boxes, instead of saying the same wording that they used to have in Microsoft Word running on the Mac, they said stuff like, oh, go up and down a directory tree to find a file. And even though I knew what it meant, and, you know, Arvi, who was in charge of IT at the time, he knew what it meant. Everybody rolling the thing out knew what it meant. So many people were confused by it. And there was little, you know, those little triangular drop-down icons that you click on instinctively.
Oh, yeah,
It was all there. Sorry, Graves was all wearing the hat. I'm the one drawing the red triangle. But it was just such a stupid little thing not to change. It made no sense.
Yes, in fact, I think people here, if I say these following words to you, will just wince. Could not get lock, var lib dpkg lock, open 11 resource temporary unavailable.
Yeah, that sucks.
What that means is you've started Synaptic already. Please use that window rather than trying to open a new Synaptic.
Good lord.
Or your update is working in the background. Yeah, you don't know why.
Correct. So that's one of the bugs that have been filed.
Right, so these paper cuts are mostly descriptive. They're not actual bugs.
Yeah, they're not bugs. They're just ways of working that are silly. all wrong or slow things down.
They're all end-user visible things, yeah. Well, at least all the ones I've seen. There are actually 466 of them filed at the moment, even though it's called 100 paper cuts.
But... Well, they commit to doing one a week, don't they? There's like 10 rounds of 10 bugs each.
Yes, like batches.
Yeah. There are some crackers in there, seriously. One of my favourites is spell check and evolution doesn't recognise Ubuntu. Well, that's an ASPEL problem, clearly, but it's still annoying.
Yeah.
And also, changing workspaces via scroll wheel is problematic. I find that problematic because I don't expect it. I'm sitting there and it just goes berserk because I've accidentally moved to the right-hand side of my mouse thing and the trackpad and my laptop, and it just goes berserk. And I wonder why. It's because you're over the scroll bar, the taskbar, obviously. Really simple things. What a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, this could go forward and be used on other projects as well. I think, you know.
Could or should?
I think should for big projects, yeah. I think for smaller projects, a good old mailing list discussion is better, but...
So you want to see the 10,000 paper cuts?
Yeah, there's just one big paper cut there.
How have they identified these as paper cuts?
I think people just submit them under that category.
There's a category of bugs in Launchpad. Right, I see.
Yeah. Then they're checked and put into a list.
Yeah, that's nice, I like that.
Mm.
Because presumably it takes 20 minutes and a bit of debate to fix most of them. The debate taking several years.
One of them is display icons in the open with list. Which is, it's just a nice, simple fix. People recognise the icons. Mm. They don't go through a list. That's my picture. I can look on that picture. Simple fix.
Yeah, I don't think there'll be many big discussions about lots of them because they're all so obvious. You know, it's like, of course, why doesn't Linux do that to start with?
Yeah.
But some are a bit harder. I mean, a bit harder. One of the ones that I know is one of your personal pet hates is the lag in loading the icons under the applications menu. So the first time you go there in GNOME, which is true, you go to applications, it pops up, and then a half second, then you have fast computers, they kind of pop out, the icons just appear because it's loaded them. And the answer is, of course, preload the icons. When we load in the menu, load the icons.
Yeah, it adds like a quarter of a second.
It looks better.
Yeah.
And that, I presume, will take a bit more time. Someone has to put a few lines of code. Maybe half a million if it's 00's anti-aliasing, perhaps. I think it's a great idea. I think more projects should do it.
Yeah.
That's how hot this topic is.
It's
engendered no debate.
Searingly hot.
It's just a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
Well done, lads. It feels a bit like zero tolerance policing, looking after the tiny little broken things, the broken windows.
It's true.
That seems to have worked in Hartlepool or New York or wherever it was.
I get them mixed up too. Yeah, this is true. But there was a story on the BBC website recently about they'd done tests on certain areas that if they put a lot of litter in a certain area, people were more likely to steal bikes. And just because it rose up the overall level of people feeling bad about a place, thinking this is a crap place. So
rubbish interface dialogues today.
Broken Asbo
hoodie package
jazz.
Management tomorrow.
Yeah. But it may be the same thing, you know, people spot these little bugs when they first use Linux, or little glitches or problems, and they think, well, it's not really finished. If we can, you know, just spend a few hours cleaning up all these, then the overall impression of the desktop may be raised enormously.
I think once a year.
What, one of these big kind of...
Yeah, I think every January, every project should just stop what they're doing.
Spring cleaning.
Spring cleaning.
Figure it out. And just go through the problem, the little problems, rather than... Because I remember one guy saying about KD4 that it's all very well saying stop adding new features, but some of their coders, if they weren't adding new features, wouldn't be doing any coding at all. They don't want to do bugs and little fixes. That's a shame. Because this kind of thing, as you say, adds a lot of polish. It looks great with these kind of things are fixed.
Yeah, it does need the discipline, though, doesn't it? I remember a few years ago, Microsoft had a... They made a big public announcement how they're having a period of like 3 months of hacking.
Yes.
They were only fixing security stuff. Problems. They were doing nothing. And they could afford to do that, and it was good publicity for them because they're paying the hackers to do it. But yeah, it's a bit hard to say to the community, no, don't implement your cool feature today, you know.
Yes.
Deal with this little bit. But
well, it's not hard to say that. Don't implement your cool feature today. Fix the little things and polish it, damn it.
Well, if you've got...
It's very easy to say. It's very hard to do.
That's why you have people like the Debian project leader to make that call and say, you know, by all means, keep hacking on this, but we won't roll it into this version that we're producing.
If you've got strong, clear leadership in a project, yeah, you can do that. If you've got somebody, you know, with a toggle switch on the CVS repository.
Or a big red button that says eject.
Yeah, I want one of those.
And with that big red button, we're now at the halfway point of our podcast. Still to come, the discovery of the week/fortnight/month, and our open ballot do version numbers matter?
It's that time of the fortnight when we look at what we've discovered the last week, 14, 7 days.
Or 7 minutes. I look at you, Graham.
3 minutes. Oh, you're going to love mine.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, dear me.
It's been on.
Never before have 14 days provoked so much hilarity. The discovery of the fortnight. It's that part of the fortnight when we look at the stuff that we've discovered this fortnight.
It says exactly what it does all the other way around.
Got a flat roof, face it, it is going to leak. Best I stop gibbering. Mike.
Hello.
You found some stupid game with a really improbable name. And
yeah, actually, can you read the name out, Andrew? Because I know you love these.
What's
names.
That say? Sour Gumdrop.
Yep, or Sour Gumdrop K, presumably. Yeah. This
isn't that a Kakura game?
It is, Paul. That's absolutely amazing. I don't know how on earth you knew that. Yeah, Kakura, I'd never heard of before. A lot of puzzle fans probably have.
Oh, isn't it the same sort of thing that Sudoku is, the Japanese puzzle type craze that took off?
Everyone's heard of it but you, then.
Yeah, I think I'm pushing myself
into
a corner.
Even the Daily Mail have heard of that.
Oh, dear. Well, yeah, in my sheltered life, I hadn't heard of it, so... these Kakura puzzles are kind of like a cross between Sudoku and a crossword. You have a grid with some areas blacked out, and you've got to insert numbers into the grid so that they add up to a number at the end, but without duplicating any numbers. And it's pretty good fun to play. But so, yeah, Sour Gumdropka is a KD implementation of this. Actually, it looks more like TCLTK, really. Of this Japanese craze, and yeah, I like it.
Awesome.
Great.
Paul, I can see you're champing at the bit to reveal what you've, something that you've written and claiming it's a discovery, or what? or what?
Mine's actually an undiscovery of the fortnight. Vala is rubbish. Now that Mono's declared safe. No, just kidding. No, after 2 weeks ago, I discovered Vala. I thought, wow, this looks really cool. Rushed in here to tell you the world about it. And then went away and tried porting my code from C# to Vala. An example project, a few hundred thousand lines of code. And immediately hit problems. I understand Vala is very much under development, so it's not their fault. It doesn't support hash region, which I use all the time for cold folding. It could just ignore it, quite frankly, but it doesn't ignore it, it just gets annoyed. It doesn't like it when you end enums with semicolons, which is probably against the language, but you know, at the very least, a semicolon by itself is an empty statement, just ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't have operator overloading, which I require, quite frankly. And I watched them discussing on the mailing list, saying, you know, no one really wants operator overloading. Yes, we do! Give us operator overloading! Anyway, so that's my undiscovery of the week. My actual discovery of the week is... if you've ever used WOOF, Web Offer One File, it lets you transfer one file over the internet to someone else, shutting down when it's done. If you like the speedy setup of WOOF, but want something slightly more longer lasting than just one file, what you want is to run this command. You run Python space dash M space simple HTTP server. And you have to cap the S in simple and the S in server and HTTP all caps.
Don't worry, it'll be in the podcast notes.
It will be, yeah. Run that command. What happens is Python will fire up a web server at port 8000.
And it will 8000?
It will serve that directory to the world immediately. Your current directory you ran that command in. So you want to serve whatever is the current directory, run that command, and everyone can download files from your current directory straight away. It's like WOOF, just better.
Cool, I'm going on IRC tonight and telling kids to go and put that into their computers so I can browse their files.
Double WOOF.
Do you need anything for that to work?
Python.
Just Python?
And a command line.
Yeah, you need Python, yeah. You need fingers to type with.
And an internet connection.
Well, you don't necessarily need fingers. You could use your nose.
You could, yeah. Sadly, I've got one of those French-style big noses, so I would run Python, I'd run... Python.
PY and then tab.
How do you hold down shift and S to get the capital S?
Oh,
it's not.
A actually, no, there's a story today. Was it in the Wall Street Journal somewhere saying caps lock should be removed because it's pointless? I use caps lock all the time.
I hate caps lock.
I use it to make sure my machine hasn't crashed all the time.
There you go.
Yeah.
It's cruise control for cool.
So what, is yours tab completion for commands on the terminal?
Hey, no, mine is something. No, mine.
Yes.
Is a piece of...
Get it together, man. Come on. The world's listening.
Cave surveying software.
Wow.
I know. Can you believe it?
It exists?
It's called X-Therion. You don't want just Therion because it doesn't have the wonderful GUI. X-Therion takes the measurements that you grab.
Yeah, carry on.
Come on, look.
I'm the only one.
Be professional, come on. Professional. Think of something to make you cry like Michael Jackson dying. Come on.
When you're next out caving,
yes,
you can make a load of measurements, write them down in a little notepad. There's even a template for the notepad if you need it. But you can also do it on your PDA.
Sounds cool.
You take those measurements back to X-Therion, type them all in, click on calculate, and it comes up with a 3D representation of the cave.
Dude, so it's like being a bat, but not in real time.
It would be helpful for bats if they'd never been to that cave system before.
And they had an internet connection. Actually, did you see also on the news, randomly, someone has figured out how to do human echolocation.
Whoa. That was in Batman. That was in like
Seriously,
the Dark Knight.
Forget Batman.
No, was someone, but that came out ages ago. I mean, it was in the news. Someone's figured out that's it.
So actually doing
remember,
it.
Batman could do it ages ago.
All right, forget you. X-Therion. That took you 2 weeks to find.
Yeah, and well, it's brilliant.
Is that because you were lost in a cave for 1.5 weeks?
Yeah. I had to do my research, make sure it worked.
Just leaves you, Andrew.
Oh, we're still on Discovery of the Week?
Yes. Yeah.
Right, well, in that case, you'd better hear my Discovery of the Week, which is the awesome configuration screens for Tor. Tor standing for the Onion Router. It's something to do with onion routing, I guess from the name, which is a kind of way of making web browsing anonymous, as I understand it. Useful for people doing dodgy things.
Also
useful for people in places where the government wants to monitor your communications, which is everywhere. Great. So now I installed it today, and the second configuration window came up with the window title. How does Tor start? Nature of Tor installation, blah, 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 blah. The path to the Tor client, user bin Tor. And then underneath it, it says, to be honest, I'm not that bright. It looks as if Tor is configured to start up by itself when your computer boots up, but I can't be sure. So can you help me? Does Tor start it by itself at boot time? And then there's a wee radio checkbox. Tor starts in the background or start Tor manually. And the whole thing is really touchy-feely. It's like a little cartoon. It's the opposite of your Ubuntu Death by a Thousand Cuts. It's nice and fluffy already.
So you want to see that elsewhere then? Like if Firefox can't find a page, it's like, dude, I'm not sure what's going on here, but the internet may be down, or it may just be this page doesn't exist.
That's what I want, and I want it configured for, you know, different locations. So it says dude if you're in, you know, California or somewhere.
But it sounds like some sort of programmer's N-way. Like Firefox should say, you know, maybe the site's down, or maybe I'm not a very good web browser deep down. Some sort of self-doubt in your web browser is what you want.
In your software.
But that's nice. I mean, they are little machines, but they were made by people with souls and humanity. I want to see more of that.
You might think that. I couldn't possibly comment.
Ding, 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 ding.
That was pretty good. That's a remix. That's the Andrew remix.
Open ballot. Do version numbers matter?
You can't see this, listeners. He's got a stack of printouts with things carefully highlighted in blue.
I highlighted the...
In the Tux Radar theme colour.
This has never happened before.
Yeah, man, this is why you're doing open ballot, not me.
Yeah. This is the useful stuff. So the question is, do version numbers matter? I guess you know the story. Should a 1.0 release be stable? Does it matter when there are so many apps that don't have the same version numbers or use the same kind of method?
Is there any software in particular lately that's made you think of this, Graham?
Well, KDE seems to be particularly bad at this. KOffice 2 was released after a lot of effort by the developers, but they admitted that it shouldn't be used by users. It was just for people to test it out and fix bugs. And it was, in fact, missing two major applications from the suite. So despite the fact that it had the 2.0 designation, it was definitely not for mainstream use or for installing in distributions. Most people who responded on the tuxradar.com website have been split. I don't know. What do we think first? What do you think, Paul?
I think there is no sane person in the world who, upon hearing KOffice 2 is not for end users, thinks, yeah, that makes sense. Because it doesn't make sense. And they can, and maybe in the small KOffice development team, they think, oh, yeah, of course that's fine. But they're making software for end users. This is what we're all doing. And if they want to say, you know, this major release version, well, it's not really for users, it's just for us. They're welcome to try that, but it's going to just confuse people more and more.
There are a lot of people that agree with you. Louis Bogard.
Louis Bogard.
says, the advantage of release numbers is that they are always easy to understand when referring to software development. They are not, however, that easy for the general public. What Ubuntu does is useful. They not only have a release number, 9.04, for example, but they also have a name. Now, those names are just code names for development, aren't they? But a lot of us refer to each Ubuntu release by their name.
I know that there have been projects that I've used, like, as I mentioned before, Window Maker, Window Manager. It's been at 0.92 for about 5-6 years now, and it's really good, it's really stable, really reliable. Why don't they just call it 1.0? Just a nice rounded number.
I know, I agree with you. I mean, VLC's just been released. 1.0.0 is the version number for that.
Wow.
You know, I wonder if it's a mistake to just say version 1, you know, of VLC.
What version was CaleMap before it died?
0.85.
0.85? So
I think you have to look at the man in the mirror.
That was definitely nowhere near a production release, despite the fact that I still get emails.
So it's just like KDE then.
I mean, yeah, I can see it from two sides. You have a kind of a target of to hit. Well, I had a target to hit for version 1. I never got there. Presumably, ICWM does as well. VLC might have done. But KOffice 2, their target must be 2.25 or 2.26.
But the thing is, they must have sat there at the planning meeting for KOffice 2 and had grand plans to get all these great features into 2.0. I think if you want to be starting something, you've got to be going off on the right track, otherwise it all goes bad.
I think what happens is that nobody, like with KD4, people worry that the developers are actually doing anything at all, so they force a release out, show what they've been working on, show that it compiles and you can actually do something with it. Yeah. But it's a long way off. Michael Schemmer says, I wish the KD team working on 4 technically had a stable release with 4.0. It just was not feature complete. They fumbled on telling us that. With 4.1, everyone knew it was unstable and feature incomplete. With 4.2, I found plasmoids and other basic features to be unstable. They should not have gone to a 4.2 release until it was tried and true.
Of course, there's another numbering system that LESS uses and some other tools, where you just increment the number all the time. It just goes up. I think LESS is at 4.29 or something now. I think it's going to be pretty cool, because there'll be like LESS 666 at some point, and that'll be evil software.
Is that like Mandriva, who are at 2009.
They are 2009.1, yeah.
That's awesome.
The 0.1 really makes it. So.
But then the other side you've got, I think my personal annoyance is Inkscape.
0.43 or...
The last stable release was 15 months ago, which was 0.46, and 2 weeks ago, after an immense amount of work, a huge number of new features, they've released the preview release of 0.47. And I get the impression they do so because they're trying to make a point. Like, yeah, 0.01 of our versions is so amazing. We're just so much better hackers than you guys who do tiny, tiny changes and release a whole major version number. Imagine what our 1.0 will look like.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome.
If you ever reach it, lads.
Maybe they have a gigantic roadmap then, you know, a feature list that's half the internet.
But it also feels, I mean, we've reviewed Inkscape in the past, and I know that we always have to spend the first paragraph explaining that I know this is 0.46, but really the developers have been working a long time on it and there's lots of new features, you know, don't be scared off. I think the problem here is in the difference between how developers approach something and how users approach it. As developers, we're used to checking things into a version control system, seeing version numbers being pumped up, but without any clear state when you get to a 1.0 state and saying this is what it does, users aren't going to get anything from that.
Didn't you say something about me to me previously, Mike? No, I released Gloss, an awesome discovery of the week, a few months ago, and you were saying how 1.0 actually does encourage people to take part.
Yeah. When I went to macOS 1.0, and I'd released like 0.9, 0.8, something not too long before that, but suddenly there was a massive uptake on people just looking around SourceForge and grabbing it.
Yeah.
Because people just thought, right, there's a new finished thing to try out instead of yet another random project that's not going to go anywhere. I'm just making a statement saying, I think this is usable now.
Yeah. My favourite comment on tuxradar.com came from Remixer96, which was quite a nice anecdotal story. A few years ago, my family had a boat called Javelin 200. The boat was, naturally, a mockery on the lake because everyone knew that to have a boat worth any salt, you needed a name at least into the thousands. So no matter how fast she went, the Javelin was always instantly relegated to second class in people's minds. I think it works the same way with software in that we see generic inflation in what people expect over time, though it does seem to be context-specific. Office apps, for example, are now considered unusual if they haven't broken the two-level release. I think, you know, I think he's right, but, Another comment from Pick Up a Penguin says, consistency is the key. I suggest everyone should shift to the de facto numbering scheme, base Redmond. Let's count to version 7. 1, 2, 3, 95, 98, 2000, ME, XP, 2003, Vista 7. I think that makes sense. That's a nice idea.
You know where you are.
Yeah.
Well, what's going to happen to Fedora once it hit 13? Are they going to say Fedora 13?
Oh, that's
Fedora. Look at Gilla Corel and say Fedora X3.
Well, we interviewed Max Spevak a while back, and he said that he was unafraid of the number 13.
Yes, but he was kicked out. Or maybe he jumped rather than being pushed. Allegedly, he was kicked out. Yeah, so some superstition in the back rooms of Red Hat, perhaps.
Well, Slackware's going ahead with 13. They're not afraid of it. Clearly, they've got a 13 release candidate out recently.
Well, you know, programmers are pretty logical guys. Has the new number 13 been proven to be unlucky, statistically?
Statistically, no.
Well,
I mean, you'd need a sample size of at least 20 messiahs.
Was it?
We don't have that many. Unless you're a Geordie. They've got them knocking
about
all over the place.
But surely, triskaidekaphobics create self-fulfilling prophecies.
Yeah, I guess if you go around constantly thinking bad stuff's going to happen with the number 13 you've created.
And with that, we come to the merry end of our podcast. But before we do, I'd just like to introduce one more thing.
Join us now and share the software. You'll be one more thing. There is just one
Can
more
I smack
thing.
Him?
No, that's not. After the show, there may be kids listening, so yeah. No violence. Here's a quick trick. Quick trick. That you can use at the command line. If you want to enter a command, but you don't want it to be stored in your bash history, simply put a space before it, and then you won't be able to get it back by pressing the up key. So this could be useful if you're going to SSH into a server and you don't want anybody knowing what you're doing. You can, of course, disable this if it becomes a problem. Look in the bash manual page and search for ignore space. That's all together one word, ignore space. And that's that.
That's a pretty average one more thing, Mike. I'm disappointed.
Do you reckon? Yeah. Are they going downhill?
Can I give you a better one?
Okay.
I've got one more thing for you. It's also a bash trick.
Right.
And it's better than that.
It can't be better than that.
It's better than that. Let's say you've just typed in a very long command on your command line, and you press enter, but it's got a typo. You want to do something with zip files, you typed ZIO, S-Z-I-O, whatever, yeah?
Yep.
Because you meant P, hit O by accident. What you do is, on the next command, you just press caret, that shift 6, the little hat symbol.
Oh, yeah.
Caret, zif, z-i-f, caret, zip.
Oh, that's just a substitution.
It will run the same command again, replacing zif for zip.
That's brilliant. Well, all instances of zif
for zip. Yeah, it replaces it all, it runs it all, it runs it again. And you can replace anything you like. replace this with that, and it'll just run it again. Same command.
That's really good. Although sometimes I do fear that all these shortcuts could eventually lead to catastrophe because you end up running some command you didn't really
That's
think
true,
you were doing.
Like, pseudo
you've got to be.
I think
careful.
I prefer mics.
What?
Oh, thanks, Graham. Yeah.
And with that, we come to the real end of our podcast. Remember, all the notes for our podcast are, of course, on the website, tuxradio.com. You can tune in 2 weeks for more hilarity. Check out our subs deal at tinyurl.com/podcastlxf. And that's it for 2 weeks. See you later. Bye.